Welcome back. Today we'll do some fun topics. One is to study a classification of exact cosmological solutions to general relativity. The main message is we can solve the Einstein equations not only in the Friedmann-Lemaître case, where we have such tremendously high symmetry, but there are solutions even for lower symmetry. And we will cover today how to classify those. And in the process, we will study a bit of group theory, Lie group theory, and that's useful not only in general relativity, but just generally it is. And then we'll study some properties of general relativity in general. Let me start by telling you about the analogy of electromagnetism. In electromagnetism, you can ask, why is there an electromagnetic field? So let's say you have a probe, you measure, is there an electromagnetic field here now? And you might find, yes, there is one. Did you realize that there are two completely different reasons, two possible reasons for why there could be an electromagnetic field here? One reason could be that there's a charge or a current, right? Obviously, that will create an electromagnetic field wherever the charge or the current is. But you can also have electromagnetic fields when there is no charge or current. And that's because the electromagnetic field can also be caused by electromagnetic fields. That would be, for example, electromagnetic waves, but not only that. For example, you can have a charge here and still an electric field over there. So you have that a field induces a field. And with gravity, it's the same thing. Curvature of space-time can have two completely different origins. One is that there is matter, that there is a non-zero energy momentum tensor. And that creates curvature right there where the matter is. Where the energy density and the pressure is, that's where curvature is being generated. But even away from masses, we have curvature. For example, the sun is far away, and still we feel the curvature here. So curvature, too, has two different origins. And just like we can decompose in electromagnetism the Maxwell equations into the homogeneous ones and the inhomogeneous ones, the homogeneous ones being just a consequence of the mathematics, and the inhomogeneous ones being non-trivial in the sense that physical input goes into that. The inhomogeneous ones are the ones where we have charges and currents inducing electromagnetic fields. A similar decomposition can be done for gravity, where the inhomogeneous equations are the Einstein equations. And then we have Bianchi identities too. So we will do these decompositions today and thereby see gravity perhaps from a new perspective, things that we hadn't done before. So, let's start with the fact that we can solve the Einstein equations not only when we assume the full set of symmetries that we assumed previously for the Friedmann, Lemaître, Robertson, Walker spacetimes. So what is the task? Let's go back to basics. The task is to solve the Einstein equation, obviously. Now, on the face of it, it's trivial to solve. It all depends on which way you go. You see, if, for example, you want to solve the Einstein equation, you can go about it this way. You give yourself an Einstein tensor. So you give yourself an arbitrary metric, calculate from it the Einstein tensor, plug it in here to the left-hand side, and then you can calculate from that what the energy momentum tensor has to be for this, and you have yourself a solution to the Einstein equation. So in principle, any kind of Lorentzian space-time is the solution to the Einstein equation. It comes with its energy momentum tensor, and that energy momentum tensor may not be reasonable. In general, it isn't. So literally every space-time is a solution to the Einstein equation. The question is it a reasonable solution? Is it a solution that could actually come about because of matter? Right? So the challenge is to find a solution to the Einstein equations for which the energy momentum tensor that follows is an energy momentum tensor that could actually conceivably occur with the matter that we know and the dynamics and the equations of motion of the matter that we know. So it's actually a highly non-trivial problem because the energy momentum tensor has to be the consequence of the equations of motion of matter. And to solve the Einstein equation together with those equations of motion for matter, that's the difficult part. So in order to solve that, we usually make symmetry assumptions to simplify the problem. A symmetry means there are way fewer parameters in there than there could be. And then having fewer parameters makes it solvable sometimes. So the strategy is that we classify the amount of symmetries that we assume. And then for whatever amount of symmetries that we assume, we can then try and solve the Einstein equation together with the equations of motion for matter. This is... In principle, you might say, OK, but we know that in cosmology, the Friedmann-Lorentz models are doing the job very well. They are a pretty accurate description of what went on in the universe, apparently. However, it is still important to look at solutions beyond that because the Einstein equation is nonlinear, and therefore it has special features in store that we would not intuitively expect from just knowing the Friedmann-Lemaître solutions. In particular, it turns out that there are solutions of less symmetry which have some nonlinear dynamics and for some period of time come arbitrarily close, epsilon close, to a Friedmann-Lemaître solution. But then before and after, it deviates strongly. I recommend that for these solutions, you look into the textbook written by John Wainwright and George Ellis. Ellis is the Ellis of Hawking and Ellis book. And John Wainwright used to be the head of the applied math department here in Waterloo. He's the one who hired me. Now, how do we characterize the symmetries and how many symmetries we have that we assume before we try to solve the Einstein equation. Let me remind you of what a symmetry is and how it relates to Killing vector fields. So we say that two space-times given by a differentiable manifold with a metric, a differentiable manifold and a metric, are called isometric. And they are therefore describing exactly the same thing, the same space-time. They're just two different descriptions of the same thing. If there exists a diffeomorphism that maps the manifold M into the manifold M tilde, so that the metric is also, the metric G is mapped into the metric G tilde. In this case, all we did was change of coordinates. Now, a space-time has a symmetry if we find such a diffeomorphism there for which actually maps from the manifold into itself. So for example, we have a manifold here. Let's describe it by M. And we have a diffeomorphism phi that maps point into point. And this could be like this cylinder and that cylinder. And you would say, all right, if there are two different manifolds and two different metrics, but there's an isometric diffeomorphism in between them, then we would say this cylinder is the same as that cylinder, same shape. But imagine we take literally the same manifold here. Well, then it means that we actually have a transformation of the manifold into itself such that the shape doesn't change. And that means, for example, in this case, it could be a rotation, right? We just take this can and we rotate it a little bit, and then we get an isomorphic can. Now, the set of symmetry transformations naturally forms a group. And a group, just to remind you, is any set. Any set is called a group if it has an operation that is often called plus, it's often called multiplication, it also has other names. Let's just be agnostic about what group it is that we are dealing with, and let's just call it this operation circle. So let's say we have a set that has an operation that we call circle, which is such that you can take any pair of elements of G and then circle them. That is to say you multiply them with this circle operation, and then you get another element of the group. So in this case, it would be a symmetry transformation and another symmetry transformation, and the circle would be the concatenation of the two. So you perform one symmetry transformation after the other, then you end up again with a symmetry transformation. But to complete the axioms of a group is a set with an operation, with a binary operation that takes two elements and maps them into one element, which is associative. It has a neutral element that we may call E, such that for any element A of the group, we have A circle E is equal to E circle A is equal to A. And also groups require, the group axioms require that every element has an inverse element. There are plenty of groups. A subset of groups is called Lie groups. And Lie groups are, by definition, groups which, in addition to being a group, also have the property that they are a finite dimensional smooth differentiable manifold. You could take, for example, the integers here. They form a group, but not a Lie group, because the integers, with the circle operation being the addition, right, have the property that you can add any two integers, get an integer, they also have inverses, the zero is the neutral element, and so on. But it's not a Lie group, because the integers don't form a differentiable manifold. But for example, the rotations of this cylinder here, right, that's a group, but it's also a group that's continuously labeled. And therefore, it's a one-dimensional manifold of rotations. It's the group that would be called U1. Another set of elements of a group that forms a Lie group is the set of rotations in three dimensions, for example. Any rotation in three dimensions is described by three angles. You need an angle above the equator, you need an angle along the equator, and you need to specify how much you rotate around that axis, right? So you get these three Euler angles there. And that gives you the rotation group SO3. Now, the symmetries of a manifold can be a group or even a Lie group. For example, you could have a manifold which has a discrete symmetry group, for example, just a reflection symmetry. Now, you can't get the reflection in a differentiable way, so that's just like a two-element group where you have the non-reflection and the reflection, and then they form a simple group, Z2. But it's not a Lie group. On the other hand, rotating a can, well, that's a one-dimensional Lie group, or rotating a ball that has a three-dimensional symmetry group. So the symmetries of a manifold, in general, can be either discrete, such as reflections, or they can form a manifold, and actually form, therefore, a Lie group. We will here focus on the symmetries that form a Lie group, so the continuously parameterized symmetries. By assumption, if G is a symmetry group, is a symmetry Lie group, and H is an element of that symmetry group, then H is a map from the manifold into itself. So it maps every point P into a target point H of P. And then we can ask, if I start with a point of the manifold, and I apply an element of the symmetry group to it, well, then it maps that point of the manifold to another point of the manifold. For example, here, this scan, right? I take this point, and I take as my element of the symmetry group a rotation by 23 degrees. Well, then that's going to be mapped into, let's say, this point. Okay. Now, if I mapped this point with a different element of the symmetry group, namely, let's say, a rotation by 27 degrees, well, then this point would be mapped into a point that's a little bit further down there, right? What happens if I take this point and I map it with all elements of the symmetry group, all elements of the rotations? Well, then the point P moves all around the can, right? 360 degrees. And the set of image points that we get in this way is called the orbit of P. So it's the orbit of P under the action of the symmetry group. So in general, the set OP, capital O of P, is called the orbit of P under the action of the group G. Now, if G is a Lie group, then each orbit is either a submanifold of the thing. For example, here it was a circle, which is a submanifold of the can. Right? The circle is one-dimensional. The can surface is two-dimensional. So it's a submanifold. But it could also be that the entire orbit just consists of the point P itself. That can happen too. I mean, for example, let's say you take the manifold, which is a sphere, and you rotate it like the Earth, and the point P is the North Pole. Well, its orbit is just itself. It's not going to move, right? Every other point, except for the North and the South Pole, are going to move. They have an orbit that's finite size, but some points might just stay the same under rotations. So the orbit is generally the point itself, or it is some submanifold of the entire manifold. Now, what are the infinitesimal versions of these isometric diffeomorphisms? And what kind of mathematical structure do we get for the infinitesimal isometries? So here we need to keep in mind that the isometric diffeomorphisms, that is to say the symmetries, symmetry transformations, they form a Lie group. But now we are looking at the infinitesimal versions of those, and we can ask, well, what happens to it? They are no longer a Lie group. What are they? And it turns out that they will be a Lie algebra. But remember that we already considered earlier in the course what an infinitesimal diffeomorphism is. And now we just have to apply this to infinitesimal isometric diffeomorphisms. So we introduced, for the purpose of studying infinitesimal diffeomorphisms, the Lie derivative. And now we will just apply that to infinitesimal isometric diffeomorphisms. So diffeomorphisms that don't actually change the manifold. Remember the Lie derivative? The Lie derivative in the direction of a tangent vector field xi of an arbitrary tensor with contravariant and covariant components is given by this expression. Notice that there are semicolons everywhere. And remember that when we first introduced the Lie derivative, these were ordinary commas. This equation is true with commas and also with semicolons. Remember, we had this, I think, before. And the reason is that it's true with commas because we derived the Lie derivative in this way. But then we can look at the origin of a geodesic coordinate system where the commas can be replaced by semicolons. And then we no longer need the origin of the Riemann normal coordinate system to conclude that if it's true in one coordinate system, it's true in all coordinate systems. So every statement that's true for the commas is actually also true for the semicolons, which is quite a non-trivial thing, because with the semicolons you get all these extra Christoffel symbols. Of course, the reverse is not true, right? Just because something is true with semicolons doesn't make it true with commas. But if it's true with commas, it's true with semicolons. For example, true for the homogeneous Maxwell equations, true with commas, but also true with semicolons. All right, so the Lie derivative in the direction of the vector field xi of a tensor is the rate of change, gives us the rate of change of a tensor field Q in the direction of the flow generated by the vector field xi. Remember that the vector field xi generates a diffeomorphism where every point is mapped into a neighboring point in the direction of the vector field xi. So the vector field xi determines a diffeomorphism, a flow. And the infinitesimal, the rate of change of the tensor field Q in the direction of that flow is given by the Lie derivative. And now we will apply this to diffeomorphisms that are isometric. That is to say, to diffeomorphisms where the metric doesn't change. So if xi describes a diffeomorphism, describes a flow, therefore a diffeomorphism, then if the metric doesn't change, it means the Lie derivative in that direction doesn't change. Right? That's a very different thing from saying that the covariant derivative is zero, because that's the matching condition between the affine connection description of curvature and the metric description of curvature. This is a highly non-trivial statement here, which is saying that as we flow in the xi direction, whatever that might be, a translation or rotation or whatever, the metric doesn't change, so the shape doesn't change. So when that condition holds, then xi generates isometric diffeomorphisms. When the manifold goes into the manifold, then the metric goes into the metric. But then, what does it mean that the Lie derivative of the metric is vanishing? Well, it means that, if we spell it out, remember, we can use this formula for the Lie derivative, not only for, you know, the tensor capital Q, but for any tensor, including the metric itself. So the Lie derivative of G, therefore, is given by xi contracted with the covariant derivative of our tensor here, and then the tensor and the covariant derivatives of the vector field, just like we have here. We have the vector field and then contracted with the covariant derivative of the tensor, that's this term, just swapping the xi and the g, but they're just numbers so we can exchange them. And here we have the tensor unchanged, but we have covariant derivatives of the vector field. So here we have covariant derivatives of the vector field, and here we have a covariant derivative of the tensor, but that is always zero because that's the condition for gamma g compatibility. All this is saying is that under parallel transport, the angles don't change. So this means that a vector field xi is generating an isometric diffeomorphism if the Lie derivative of g is vanishing, which is to say if the sum of these two terms is vanishing, which is to say that this is vanishing, because we can use the g to pull down these indices. So here we have this condition for a Killing vector field. It's the anti-symmetry of this xi mu nu tensor. So how many Killing vector fields could we possibly have? How many independent Killing vector fields could we possibly have in a space-time with n dimensions? We know which condition is to be fulfilled, so we should be able to figure out how many solutions this equation can possibly have. And the answer is that the maximum number of Killing vector fields that we can have is n times n plus 1 half. And I'll explain in a moment why that is. But one thing you see right away is that this is larger than n. Right? Now, Killing vector fields are tangent vector fields. And there are only n basis vectors in an n-dimensional manifold. But you see, we are talking here not about how many Killing vector fields at one point can be linearly independent. The answer is n. But it's Killing vector fields at all points, you see? And that's a very different question. You know, we have an infinite dimensional space of vector fields, even though at every point we only have a finite dimensional tangent vector space. It's just like, you know, a function can only take one value at a point, but it takes, you know, a function over all of space, of course, takes at every point another value. So in total, we can have n times n plus 1 half linearly independent vector fields. And how do we count that? Well, there are two ways to obey this Killing vector field condition. One is that these derivatives could vanish, right? So if such a derivative vanishes, if both of these derivatives vanish, well, then we're in business, obviously, right? So we don't even have to rely on anti-symmetry if the individual components are vanishing. But how many are there of those? Well, at most 4, right? Because we have the mu from 1 to 4 there. On the other hand, we can also have that these covariant derivatives do not vanish, but that we have anti-symmetry in this. So then we can ask, well, OK, if this is a matrix with indices mu and nu that's anti-symmetric, how many entries does it have? Well, it has n squared half because of the anti-symmetry, right? So the upper triangle must be the same as the lower triangle of this matrix, up to a minus sign, so it's only n squared half, but then it's 0 on the diagonal, so you have to subtract an n. And that leaves us with n times n minus 1 half. Because that's n squared half minus n half. So overall, then, the total maximum number is n from how many we can have that are just 0 right away, plus n minus one, n times n minus 1 half that can be anti-symmetric, and the sum of them is n times n plus 1 half. Quick calculation, how many is that for space-time? So if n is equal to 4.
10.
Yeah, exactly. 4 times 5, half 10. Now, let's go from a symmetry Lie group to the infinitesimal version now. Remember, this was all to see the infinitesimal, to describe the infinitesimal isometric diffeomorphisms. The finite isometric diffeomorphisms form a group, a Lie group. The infinitesimal ones form what is called a Lie algebra. This is a very general phenomenon, way beyond differential geometry. Whenever you have a Lie group, then it induces also Lie algebra, and vice versa, the Lie algebra generates a Lie group. Now, this is going to be a little bit abstract, but it's beautiful. And if you're interested in Lie group theory, these are the elementary basics of it. So a Lie group, remember, a Lie group is a smooth manifold. And that's what makes a group a Lie group. That in addition to being a group, it's also a differentiable manifold. So for example, rotations, right? Rotations in R3 form a group because you can compose any two rotations and what you end up with is a rotation. And there's an inverse and there's a neutral. But the rotations in three dimensions, or any number of dimensions, also form a manifold because they are labeled in a continuous, in fact, in a differentiable way. So they form actually a manifold. But a Lie group, when viewed as a manifold, is not only a manifold. It's also a group. So for example, you can think of a Lie group like, let's say, a sphere. That could be a Lie group of rotations, right? So take a Lie group, let's say it's a sphere. Then every point of that manifold is a group element. So that's a very special manifold now, because you can take points of the manifold and multiply them with each other, right? That is not something that you would normally do in differential geometry, that you take a point of a manifold, another point of the manifold, and then multiply them to get another point of the manifold, generally somewhere completely different. Right? Normally we don't do that because we don't have an operation for this. But if the manifold is actually a manifold of group elements, then we can say, oh yeah, this is a point of the manifold, but it's also a group element. It's also a rotation. And that point is a point of the manifold, but it's also a group element. So it's also a rotation. So we multiply those two rotations, we get another rotation out of this. And that's again a point in the manifold. So here point, there point, multiply and get a point somewhere else. But if you are close to the identity element, which is just a point on the manifold, then things simplify a bit. So remember that every Lie group is a group, therefore it has a neutral element. For example, the zero rotation, where all angles are zero. Right? So you have this neutral element. And now if you take the neutral element and you multiply that with an element that's very close to it, on the manifold, very close to it, then that's an element that's also close to one, right? I mean, close to the identity. So you multiply a neutral element with an element that's almost a neutral element. And so that means the product of the two is also not going to be very far away from the neutral element. And that makes the neutral element a very special place on the manifold. And the tangent space to that neutral element has an extra structure because of it, as we will see now. So let us now consider the tangent space to our Lie group, the tangent space to the point of the Lie group, to the manifold, which is the identity element. Now that tangent space is a vector space, right? And it has finite dimensions. For example, if we have a three-dimensional rotation group, then at the origin, that is to say, not in the middle of it, I mean, one point of the manifold is the neutral element, the rotation by 0 degrees in any direction. At that point, you have a tangent space, and that tangent space has dimension 3 in this case. Now, ordinarily, a tangent space to a manifold at a point, it's just that. It's just a tangent space. But if it's the tangent space to the identity of a Lie group, then there's extra structure. Remember how I said that a Lie group is a differentiable manifold? You can take a point here and a point there and then actually multiply them with respect to the group, and you get another point somewhere else. That structure that we have on top of it being a differential manifold, that group structure leaves a trace also in the tangent space to the identity. So there is, in the tangent space inherits an infinitesimal version of the group multiplication. And that means that the tangent space is equipped not only with the usual addition of vectors in the tangent space, but there's also a kind of multiplication of the elements of the tangent space. And the tangent space, equipped with that extra multiplication for tangent vectors now, among tangent vectors, that's what is called a Lie algebra. Not only here in general relativity, differential geometry, and tangent spaces to space-time, but just in complete generality. Whenever you have a Lie group, You look at the tension space to the identity, and that tension space as a vector space is a vector space with an extra operation, the so-called Lie multiplication. In fact, if we are given just this structure, the tension space, the tension space to the identity together with its Lie multiplication, then we can already reconstruct what the full Lie group was. Not necessarily uniquely, though. For example, if we take the rotation group and we look at its Lie algebra, that is to say, its tangent space, that's the rotations in 3D, the tangent space and its Lie multiplication, then we can try to generate that, because we have the infinitesimal Lie group there, the Lie algebra, we can try to generate from that all the rotations again, and we get all of the rotations, but we also get more. Namely, we get the spin generalization of it. We get not only the SO3, we also get the SU2. And nature apparently cares for this, which is why we have spin in electrons. So in a way, some would say that Lie algebras are more fundamental than Lie groups. Because for every Lie group, you just get one Lie algebra. But from a Lie algebra, you may get several Lie groups. This goes a little bit beyond general relativity, but it's interesting. So, okay. Now, let us collect the properties that the inherited multiplication of all the Lie algebras in general share. In our case, but also in general. So, a Lie algebra is defined to be any set which has the following properties. A Lie algebra, first of all, has to be a vector space. And this in practice will be the tangent space to the identity of a Lie group. But to define a Lie algebra, we don't need to refer to Lie groups. We can just start with the Lie algebras as the primary thing. And then what we do is we say that any vector space is called a Lie algebra if it possesses a binary operation, typically indicated with this curly bracket here. We could also make a circle again or whatever. But traditionally, this binary operation is indicated with curly brackets. And it is an operation that takes, again, two elements of the set. In this case, two tangent vectors or two elements of this vector space and maps them into a vector. However, the properties are now that in order to qualify to be called a Lie algebra, we must have that two vectors Lie multiplied in this way, have to pick up a minus sign when multiplying in the opposite direction. So it's an anti-symmetric multiplication, anti-commutative multiplication. And it's not associative. Instead, the Lie multiplication is required to be obeying the Jacobi identity. So it's this expression here plus cyclically permuted plus cyclically permuted. Right? You see this R, there's RST, and then it's RST. Right? And then you take TRS, and then it's TRS. So you just cyclically permute through. So every vector space A that is equipped with a multiplication that obeys these axioms is called a Lie algebra. And there's a theorem that says that it is isomorphic, it's automatically isomorphic to the tangent space to a Lie group. And this multiplication is inherited from the multiplication of the Lie group. And now applied to our case here, the proposition is that the set of Killing vector fields, Xi I, that a spacetime may possess, forms a Lie algebra. So if there are Killing vector fields, they do form a Lie algebra. I leave it to you as an exercise to prove this. I just give you a hint if you want to do it. So if you want to prove that if there is a bunch of Killing vector fields, they form a Lie algebra, right? You have to check those axioms, right? And so what you need to do is first come up with an idea of how you would multiply them. Clearly, they form a vector space because you can add two Killing vector fields, and the sum of the two is clearly also a Killing vector field. That's not hard to prove. See, if you have a one Killing vector field that is producing an antisymmetric tensor, then the sum of the two is also producing one. Sum of two of them is also producing one. Okay, so what is the multiplication then? What is the Lie multiplication of the Killing vector fields? So what is this curly bracket supposed to be? Well, you take the curly bracket of two Killing vector fields to be the commutator of them. Remember, that's just, you know, what are Killing vector fields doing? They're vector fields. Therefore, they take a function and differentiate it and output a function again, right? And so you can concatenate them, arbitrary sequence, and that's what that is. So then you just need to show that they obey the Jacobi identity, because from this it's already guaranteed that they are antisymmetric, that the multiplication is antisymmetric. Okay, summary of the big picture so far. The symmetries of any space-time form a group. And remember, a space-time doesn't need to have any symmetries at all, but if it does have symmetries, then they form a group. and that's because the symmetries can always be concatenated. If you have one isometric diffeomorphism and another isometric diffeomorphism, you can always compose them, and then the total is just an isometric diffeomorphism again. So they definitely form a group, also because the identity map is always the neutral element, and there's always an inverse diffeomorphism. That's part of the definition of diffeomorphism, that it has an inverse. So clearly they form a group. Now, some of these symmetry groups will be Lie groups, because they will be smoothly parametrized. Now, each Killing vector field is the infinitesimal generator of a flow of isometric diffeomorphisms. That is to say, each Killing vector field is not, I mean, every vector field can be used to generate a flow. Every vector field, therefore, can be used to generate a diffeomorphism. But the Killing vector fields are special in that they generate isometric diffeomorphisms, because the Lie derivative of the metric in the direction of a Killing vector field is vanishing. And we have that the Killing vector fields form a Lie algebra. And every Lie algebra then generates a Lie group, and that's returning to the symmetry group that we started with. Now, remember that when we considered the orbits of a point on the manifold under the action of a symmetry group, we found that the orbit could be some submanifold, or it could be just a point. For example, if you rotate the globe, that's a symmetry. Every point will have an orbit except for the north and the south pole. They don't have an orbit. And we can generally distinguish, let's say, in Minkowski space, just to get back to space-time, we can generally distinguish between symmetries that that have always an orbit and some symmetries that do not necessarily have a finite orbit, that have just a point. So, for example, if you take Minkowski space and the origin of the coordinate system, then rotations will not change the origin. But translations will give every point of the manifold an orbit. Right? So translations are symmetries in Minkowski space, translations in space, translations in time, and they form what is called homogeneous symmetries, whereas rotations form isotropies. And the technical distinction is that the isotropies have points that they leave the same. So for example, when cosmologists say, oh, I'm going to consider a space-time with full isotropy and full homogeneity. What that means is, full isotropy means that the symmetry, the isotropy symmetry group is all rotations in any direction. And full homogeneity means that we assume that we have translation invariance in the x, y, and z direction. So you can think of homogeneous symmetries as translations or generalized translations, and the isotropies as generalized rotations. Generalized because, for example, a Lorentz transformation is not a rotation, but it's kind of like a rotation, right? Yeah. Okay, so let's start with the definition. Let's call the dimension of the Lie algebra of Killing vector fields R. So let's say, if we say, colloquially say we have R Killing vector fields, then what we mean is, of course, not that we have R Killing vector fields, because there are really infinitely many then. Because you can have, if you have two Killing vector fields, any linear combination of them is a Killing vector field, so there are infinitely many. What's really meant is that this dimension of the space of Killing vector fields is R, right? So let's say that the Lie algebra of Killing vector fields viewed as a vector space is R-dimensional. Then remember that the set of points that a point P flows to under the symmetry transformations, which are generated by the Killing vector fields, is called the orbit. And then the orbit that this point undergoes. And then we can ask, well, what's the dimension of that orbit? For example, when we had the soda can, and we took a point and we rotated the can, well, then the orbit clearly was one-dimensional, whereas the can was two-dimensional. So let's give a dimension, let's give a name to the dimension of the orbits of our points. And let's call that dimension S. And clearly, for example, on a sphere, we could have rotations this way, we could have rotations that way. If we take a point and we allow all those rotations, well, that's going to be a two-dimensional orbit, right? So what we have is that the number of dimensions that the orbits have, or that, let's say we pick a point and we ask, okay, for this point now, what is the dimension of its orbit, the dimension S? Now, it's clearly at most as large as the number of dimensions of the Lie algebra of Killing vector fields. But it can actually happen that S is smaller than the number of dimensions of the Killing vector field. So for example, let's consider as our manifold R2, just R2. And as the point, we consider the origin. Then what is the largest number of Killing vector fields that we can have? What would you say in two-dimensional space? What's the maximum number of Killing vector fields that we can have? We had a formula for it. N times n plus 1 half. Right? So it would be 2 times 2 plus 1. So it's 3 half. So it's 6 half. It's 3. OK, so that's the maximum number of Killing vector fields. Intuition, what would they be? Well, we have a translation in the x direction, translation in the y direction. And we have rotations, one-dimensional rotation group in R2, right? OK, so that's three. We will see them in a moment. So we have a three-dimensional Lie algebra of Killing vector fields, which is spanned by three basis Killing vector fields. And concretely, we can choose these three as the basis vectors. We have One Killing vector field is just d by dx, another one is d by dy, another one is y d by dx minus x d by dy. Why do they generate the symmetries in question? Do you see why they would be the generators of translation in the x direction, translation in the y direction, rotation around 0, 0? You see why that is? Yeah?
If I take a linear combination of k1 and k2, then, uh-huh. which is exactly what k3 in a sense is, then you can return to the same point, so that could represent a...
Not quite. Because you see, you can't linearly combine those to get this, because there's a y and x dependence in there, right? At the point you could, but not generally, right? I mean, that's the reason why there could be three independent ones, even in R2, right? It's because as vector fields, they are not linearly independent. No, the point is this. What happens if you actually exponentiate d by dx? What is this thing doing in quantum mechanics? I mean, for example, this in quantum mechanics, this could be e to the power of I times a p hat, the momentum operator, right? Setting h bar equal to 1. What is this doing? When you apply that operator on a wave function, what is this? E to the power I a p hat acting on psi of x. Remember what it does?
Power series.
It's psi of x plus a. It's translating. That's why we say that the momentum operator is the generator of translations. You may wonder, why the heck is that so? Well, let's just calculate it. We have e to the power a d by dx, and we apply that to psi of x. What is this? This is the sum over n equals 0 to infinity. And then we have, OK, a to the power n. And then we have over n factorial dn dxn psi of x. This is psi of x plus a. Why? This is the Taylor expansion of it. Right? This is just a Taylor expansion around the point x. And we go by a to the side. By Taylor. Right? And then if you remember from quantum mechanics, you also have that e to the power of, and then you have I alpha L hat 3. And you apply that to a wave function, like psi of x, then what you get is psi of rx, where r is a matrix that rotates the x vector around the 3 axis, around the z axis, by the angle alpha. And that's a generalized version of what Taylor would be. OK, but this is not a class on quantum mechanics. Anyway, so what we have is these guys generate translations in the x direction, translations in the y direction, and rotations around the 0, 0 point. OK, so then what is the orbit of the point P under the action of these Killing vector fields? Well, the orbit is R2 because the generators d by dx and d by dy already generate the flow to everywhere. So what we say is that the orbit generated by them is also called the surface of homogeneity. It's where you can go by translations, by symmetry translations. We say that this surface of homogeneity has dimension 2, because it's all of R2. And that is less than R. We have 3 Killing vector fields. And the orbit has a dimension that's smaller than the number of Killing vector fields. Because we don't even need the rotations to have an orbit, to have all of R2 as an orbit. So what's the role of K3? Remember, we call these translations here, we call them generators of, I mean, these killing vector fields, we call them translators of generators of translations. And what they generate is an orbit, which is then called the surface of homogeneity. So the other, the remaining killing vector field, the one that rotates, the K3 field, has the job of generating rotations. And the symmetry associated with that is called an isotropy. So we say that those killing vector fields, which do not generate a homogeneity surface, that is to say, which generate a trivial group orbit for a point, in this case the point 0, 0, we say that they are generating what is called the isotropy subgroup. This could be rotations or generalized rotations, such as Lorentz transformations. So it's the isotropy subgroup generated by the K3. So remember that all the killing vector fields together generate the full symmetry group, and there is a isotropy subgroup generated by just the K3. So what is the dimension D of the isotropy subgroup? Well, it's the number of all killing vector fields minus the number of killing vector fields that actually generate a group orbit. So in our case, that's 3, the number of total number of killing vector fields, minus S, which is the number of killing vector fields that actually generate orbits. And so that's just 1 here. OK, so now we have the tools to describe the starting point for those who solve the Einstein equation with less symmetry than the Friedmann-Lemaître models. So what they do is this. They start with a classification of how much symmetry they assume. So first they say, oh, I'm going to work with a dimension of the isotropy group D. So this is a statement of how much isotropy they assume. For example, you could imagine a universe, a model for the universe, which has an isotropy in the sense that if I rotate in the xy plane, in some coordinate system, in the xy plane, then the universe doesn't change. It looks the same. It's isometric. We have an isotropy in that, in those rotations. But maybe the universe, but maybe we want to have a model such that this is the only isotropy. And you can't rotate this way without changing the shape of it, right? So we specify a number of dimensions for the isotropy subgroup. And how large could the isotropy subgroup be, possibly? Well, the number is 6. Clearly, we have the 3 dimensions of rotations, but then we also have the Lorentz transformations. The Lorentz group itself has 6 dimensions. So at most 6. And the Friedmann-Lemaître models assume how many? 3.
Also just the isotropies.
Yes, just the spatial rotations. And then, so you make up your mind how much symmetry you assume of the type of the isotropy. So you pick a number between 0 and 6. And then you say, OK, I also have to assume something about how much homogeneity the universe has. For example, you could have full translation invariance in the x direction. But in the y direction, no. And in the z direction, yes, it has full translation invariance, for example. Right? So what do we assume about the dimension of the homogeneity surfaces? And how much can we have there? Well, we can have at most 4 dimensions of generalized translation symmetries, right? In space, 3, and then in time. So we pick a number between 0 and 4. Okay, so now if it's zero, so we assume no translation symmetry at all, then we call this an inhomogeneous assumption, which is of course the most realistic case. And then if we choose four full dimensions of homogeneity, then we say it's the same everywhere. I mean, we can translate whichever way we, however much we want, but also in time. And then that would be fully homogeneous. Now, the Friedman-Lemaitre models, what do they assume for S? Three, right? Because we are not assuming that it stays the same in time. Okay, so, actually I have to speed up a bit. So overall, the message is that if you pick your choice of how much isotropy, how much homogeneity you choose to assume, right? Then you pick that, like four dimensions of homogeneity and three isotropy, then you get Einstein's static model, right? Or you, with four and one, you get Gödel's model and so on. Friedman-Lemaitre is three and three, as we discussed, right? So we have three translations, three rotations, but don't mess with time. And so on, and you know, you can go through the various combinations, and a lot is known about those, and that's explained, for example, in that text that I mentioned earlier by Wainwright and by Ellis. Now, there is a powerful alternative way to classify, so we're switching gears here, powerful alternative way to classify spacetimes. And the idea there is not to work with the curvature side directly, but to work via the energy momentum tensor. So we classify the possible energy momentum tensors, and then once we have that, we obtain from that a classification of the possible Ricci tensors, because the energy momentum tensor determines the Ricci tensor. And here's the proposition, a key proposition here. First of all, remember the perfect fluid energy momentum tensor. And we said it's an assumption. That's sometimes a good one. Namely that the energy momentum tensor takes the form of a perfect fluid. But in general, it doesn't. In general, however, it can always be put into this form, where we have a unique time-like vector field u, and then we have coefficients mu and a vector q and another coefficient p and a tensor pi. So all the energy momentum tensors that can reasonably be produced by matter of the kind that we know can be written in this way. If for some reason these terms vanish, well, then it's a perfect fluid energy momentum tensor. But in general, these guys might also be there. This time-like vector field u is also called the fundamental four-velocity field. So for example, for a perfect fluid, this is, in fact, the fluid velocity. And we showed earlier that actually, it's describing a geodesic. And remember that the equation of state for a perfect fluid is that the pressure is proportional to the energy density, and the ratio of pressure to energy density is the W parameter. And for example, W is 1 for dust, it's 4/3 for radiation, and it's 0 for cosmological. This gamma parameter is 1 for dust, it's 4/3 for radiation, and it's 0 for the cosmological constant. But one doesn't usually use the gamma parameter when one uses this W parameter. Now, when you look up the literature on solutions to the Einstein equations for cosmology, you will sometimes find the term tilted cosmology, tilted spacetime. What that means is that if the spacetime possesses three homogeneity symmetries, and yet the fundamental velocity is not orthogonal to that, then we say that the cosmology is tilted. It ought to be orthogonal, because what that would mean, for example, if you have three spatial homogeneities, three translation invariances, that fluid doesn't actually flow somewhere in these directions. It would just age going up in time, right? It would not flow anywhere, because ordinarily you would say, well, if it flows somewhere, then it singles out a particular direction, right? But you know, you can have, as we discussed earlier, you can have that something is stationary or static, right? You can have that, for example, a fluid, it could be just addressed, and so nothing changes, but it could also be in motion, but in such a way that the overall motion field doesn't change, right? Okay. All right, so the idea here is that we work with the energy momentum tensor and we classify it. Highly non-trivial business. And the reason is this: the T-mu-nu tensor is symmetric. So therefore, it looks as if it would be an easy game, because if it's a symmetric matrix, we can diagonalize it and then classify it by its eigenvalues. Yeah, it's not that easy, because the inner product in the Lorentzian manifold is not positive definite. So therefore, the spectral theorem doesn't apply. T-mu-nu is not Hermitian as a matrix, but you can make it Hermitian by raising one of the indices, because then what used to be the metric with its indefinite signature becomes the metric with one index up, one index down, and that's just a Kronecker delta. But T mu nu with one index up, one index down is generally no longer symmetric. So the spectral theorem doesn't apply then either. So what you have to do then is to take the next best thing after the spectral theorem and calculate the Jordan normal form. Jordan normal form you can always calculate. And what that gives then is a classification according to the Jordan normal form decomposition of matrices. And that's just linear algebra. And what that gives us is a classification that is called the Segre classification, that gives us four main types of energy momentum tensor. But there's really no point in going into the details of the Segre classification now. Now, let's remember the strategy here. If we classify the T-mu-nus, as we do using the Jordan classification, then via the Einstein equations, that gives us a classification of possible curvatures. And you might wonder, well, let's see, we have R mu nu minus 1 half G mu nu R equal to T mu nu with the gravitational constant here. And I was claiming that if you know T mu nu, you can calculate what the Ricci tensor is. It doesn't look obvious, right? Why would that be true? Just because you know that, what you get is the Einstein tensor. But do you really get the Ricci tensor? It turns out, and mark my words, this is special, in four dimensions you can do it. It so happens that if space-time is four-dimensional, like 3 plus 1 as in our case, then the Einstein equation is completely equivalent to this equation, which means it's kind of self-dual. For some weird reason, nobody quite knows how to use that fact, because it's only true in four dimensions. You see, you take the trace of it to get the trace of T, the trace of R here, and then you get the relationship between R and the T, which is the trace of T, and then you can solve that equation and put it in that form. Right? And that tells us that if you know the energy momentum tensor, you actually do get the Ricci tensor out of this, right? Very cool. So classifying the energy momentum tensor using the Segre classification gives you a classification of the Ricci tensor. And please do it. It's a very cool calculation. Just derive from this that and find out that it's dimension dependent. That has to do with the fact that you have to contract this with the metric. Right? And then it matters how many terms you have in there. So What that means is that the 10 degrees of freedom of the symmetric matrix T mu nu determine the 10 degrees of freedom of the symmetric R mu nu. Now, does that mean that classifying the energy momentum tensor gives us the classification of the curvature? And it doesn't, because it's only half the story. It's only a classification of the Ricci tensors, but the Ricci tensor is not that rich after all. It only knows half of the Riemann curvature tensor. It only has 10 degrees of freedom. It's a symmetric matrix, so it has 10 degrees of freedom. The full Riemann curvature tensor with its four indices has plenty of symmetries and anti-symmetry, and what's left over is 20 degrees of freedom. So this only classifies 10 of them. So we are missing something. And what is it that we are missing? If we are classifying only the Ricci curvature using the Segre classification of the energy momentum tensor, then what we are missing is something that I mentioned at the very beginning of the class today. Electromagnetic fields can be caused in two ways, by charges and currents, or by electromagnetic fields. Because when a magnetic field decays, it produces an electric field. When an electric field decays, it produces a magnetic field. The same is true for gravity. Gravity has, if you dig into the details of the Einstein equations, has very analogous things, where you have a gravitomagnetic, a gravitoelectric type of thing. It's all gravity, of course, but it's like one part of gravity induces the other part of gravity, and so you can have gravitational waves. Okay, so what we are missing here is the part that doesn't rely on the presence of matter. Just like electromagnetism has electromagnetic fields that can exist even where there are no charges and currents. And so gravity too, curvature, can exist. And of course it does exist even where there is no matter. For example, you know, the sun curves space even here where it is not. Okay, so what is it exactly that we are missing? Well, what we are missing is the Weyl tensor. The Weyl tensor is this unwieldy object here. You know, it's expressed in terms of the Riemann curvature tensor. It's the Riemann curvature tensor minus all of this, which is expressed in terms of the Ricci tensor. And once we have the Ricci tensor and the so-called Weyl tensor here in red, once we have both of them, then we have complete knowledge of the Riemann curvature tensor. The Riemann curvature tensor is the Weyl tensor plus this stuff in terms of the Ricci tensor. So this means that the Riemann curvature tensor uniquely, basis independently, decomposes into the Weyl tensor and the Ricci tensor. And each one of them has 10 degrees of freedom. So what that means is that we still need to classify the Weyl curvature, which is all that curvature that can exist even where there is no matter. And the Weyl curvature has a special property, which is that if you have a manifold with a metric, and then you put onto that same manifold a different metric, which is obtained just by scaling, so you take the old metric and multiply with the scalar positive function here, then the Weyl tensor goes into itself. And what that means is that Weyl curvature is pure deformation. So if, for example, you have a circle and Weyl curvature goes through it, it cannot make the circle bigger or smaller. It might tilt it, it might squeeze it this way, it might squeeze it that way, but it cannot make it bigger or smaller. The bigger and smaller business in all of the various directions is the business of the Ricci scalar. So the Ricci tensor. So the Ricci tensor and therefore energy momentum, they are squeezing and stretching space-time, whereas the Weyl curvature is only a deformation. It's only kind of a, maybe you can think of it as a shear. a brief remark. Initially, Einstein and Fokker thought of a theory of general relativity that was supposed to be of the form that the metric was a scalar function times the special relativistic metric. That theory was generally covariant, and everything worked out except not experimentally. So it was not consistent with the perihelion shift of Mercury, and it also wouldn't describe the light bending correctly. So they abandoned that, of course. Okay, so via the Einstein equation, the Segre classification of the energy momentum tensor gives us the classification of the Ricci tensors. Now it remains to classify the remaining Weyl tensor, the remaining Weyl curvature. So while the Segre classification classifies the Ricci curvature, so the expanding shrinkage stuff, the so-called Petrov classification classifies the Weyl curvature, which does the squeeze, not the squeezing, which does the deformation stuff. And how can we do that? Well, the Weyl tensor is anti-symmetric in the first two indices, anti-symmetric in the other two indices, and symmetric between the two, which means it looks as if it is, again, a symmetric matrix, just with double indices. But again, we are screwed, because in that space, the metric is indefinite. So the spectral theorem doesn't apply, which means that just before with the Segre classification, here too, we can't rely on the spectral theorem. So we use the Jordan normal form decomposition in order to classify the Weyl curvatures. And this space is now higher dimensional because this index, this tensor has four indices rather than the energy momentum tensor with its only two. And so what we get is actually six Petrov classes, whereas for the Segre classification, we had four of them. And let's just go briefly through what they are. We get type 0, D, N, type 1, and 2, and 3. So type 0 would be that the Weyl curvature simply vanishes. Type D would be static Weyl curvature, for example, in the vicinity of a star. So that's the curvature that exists between the Earth and the Sun, where there's no matter, there's still curvature, and it's Weyl curvature of type D. But then there's also Weyl curvature of type N. That would be, for example, transverse gravitational fields, the type that LIGO detects. And this is literally gravitational fields. Their amplitude decays. The energy that they carry decays like 1 over r from the source. And then there's type 1, which is longitudinal gravitational waves. Now, that's the gravitational near field. Just like an antenna, an electromagnetic antenna, has an electric field and a magnetic field in its close vicinity, which is simply generated by the fact that there's a charge up or a charge down or a current flowing that is immediately creating a near field to the antenna, right? That field is very strong, but it decays very quickly. The electromagnetic near field decays very quickly. And it also has a longitudinal component. However, the electromagnetic far field, the kind of field that decays much more slowly, the kind of field that actually carries energy away, is caused by electromagnetic fields decaying and inducing each other along the way. So that's electromagnetic fields. And in gravity, it's the same thing. You have, if you shake a mass, you will have immediately in the vicinity of where the mass is being shaken, there you have these gravitational near fields that can be strong, but they don't reach very far. But then further away, you have that the fields induce each other. You have gravitational fields. So you have, for a short distance from the source, you have longitudinal gravitational waves. So electromagnetic fields near to the antenna can have longitudinal parts, but far away they cannot. And the same with the gravitational fields. And that's important because it means that the number of polarizations drops because it doesn't have polarization in the longitudinal direction. That's because it can't propagate faster than the speed of light. But longitudinal polarization would kind of, intuitively speaking, require that it vibrates in the propagation direction. And then, of course, there are cases where we have a mixture of all these cases. Now, there is, in principle, a problem with these symmetry cases and classification. Because you could imagine that, let's say you fix some assumptions about symmetries, then you solve the equations of motion with a lot of mathematical ingenuity, and then you find a certain conclusion, and then you wonder, yeah, but is it stable? Right? If I go away a little bit from that symmetry, does everything change? Or do I get something that's very close to that? And that stability analysis is very hard to do. Which is why people like Penrose and Hawking and others have put a lot of effort into so-called, for example, singularity theorems. The most important case is that of cosmology, where the Friedmann-Lemaître model assumes a lot of symmetry. And if you, for example, assume radiation domination, you can solve the entire problem. And you get the square root of t solution for the scale factor. And it tells you at t equal to 0, that was a big bang there, right? But you could imagine that that's fake. It could easily be. Because if you run it backwards, your Friedmann-Lemaître solution, run it backwards, you find it increasing density, and then suddenly there's supposed to be the singularity. Compare that with an ice dancer. So there she is on the ice, and she's rotating, and then she's pulling together her arms, and she keeps spinning faster and faster and faster, right? Now, who's to say that that doesn't happen in cosmology? If you take our current universe and you run it backwards, maybe there's a little bit of excess angular momentum. And then as you look at it in earlier and earlier times, you know, as stuff gets more and more concentrated, it could be that intuitively speaking, it's like with the dancer, with the ice dancer, and things start spinning like crazy, maybe preventing the formation of a singularity. Just like, you know, the dancer, eventually, if she was very, very thin, at some point, if she puts her arms closer and closer together, you know, she would drill a hole into the ice, and she would go spinning like the speed of light or whatever, right? So, you know, the ice dancer will hit a boundary at some point when she cannot, it would just be too hard to actually pull the arms further together, right? If she was very, very thin and she starts with some appreciable angular momentum. So maybe space-time too. Maybe the exact solution without any spin predicts a singularity, but maybe in reality any contamination would prevent it. That's why singularity theorems were developed and proven, and that's why Roger Penrose got the Nobel Prize eventually. Because it's important to prove that stability there. Similar for black holes. How do we know that matter doesn't just go crazy spinning to avoid the collapse into a black hole eventually? Again, we have theorems, and we will do that soon in this course. You know, how to see exactly how does a singularity theorem work, so that we can actually conclude that even if we don't have exact symmetries, but just make some reasonable assumptions about how, you know, the initial conditions are there of the matter, that we can still conclude that a singularity must form. So this is just to raise your interest for one of the things that will come up next, namely, how can we be sure that, for example, singularities really form, even when we can't solve it exactly. Okay, that's it so far today.